I want you to take a second and just think about the last time you went to a doctor's visit.
Right, sitting on that crinkly paper on the exam table.
Exactly, the crinkly paper. Did you feel like, you know, a living, breathing person with this complex, messy life? Or did you feel a bit more like just a collection of symptoms, like a laboratory value that needed to be fixed, or maybe just a diagnostic code on a chart?
Yeah, that is the it's the universal feeling, I think. You go in as a human and you get processed as a biological machine.
Right. And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into this incredibly fascinating paradigm-shifting academic white paper. It's by Dr. Bechara Celi, and it's called the Life Coherence Clinical Assessment.
Which is a bit of a mouthful, but the concepts inside are just, they're revolutionary.
Completely. And I want to be really clear right out of the gate for everyone listening. Our mission today is not to, like, bash conventional medicine, right? We're not saying you should throw away your antibiotics and try to cure a bacterial infection with good vibes and positive thinking.
No, absolutely not. The biomedical model is incredible at what it does.
Right. But what this paper explores is a radical yet incredibly practical framework that tries to transform the way doctors look at us. It's about completing modern medicine, not replacing it.
And what's fascinating here is that modern medicine, I mean, it is just staggeringly good at identifying disease. If you have a blocked coronary artery, we can find it and stent it, but it is often remarkably blind to the actual life that the disease has interrupted.
Yeah, and that's the core issue, right? Like every single day, all across the globe, doctors are writing millions of perfectly correct, scientifically backed prescriptions. But they are absolutely guaranteed to fail.
Right. And not because the medicine is bad or the doctor made a mistake with the diagnosis.
Exactly. It's because the prescription requires a lifestyle that the patient simply doesn't have.
Oh.
So by the end of this deep dive, I promise you, you are going to have a completely new vocabulary for understanding your own health, your next doctor's visit, and really what it truly means to heal. So, okay, let's unpack this. We have to start by accurately diagnosing the problem, right?
Yeah, you can't understand the solution until you really dissect the architecture of the problem. And that means looking closely at the conventional clinical method itself.
Right, the standard algorithm every doctor uses.
Exactly. When you go into a clinic with a symptom, the physician basically deploys this highly refined algorithm. They take your history, they do a physical exam, they order some specific investigations or labs.
They hunt for the problem.
Right, they identify the pathological entity, they stratify your risk based on, you know, huge population data sets, and then they apply an evidence-based intervention.
And I mean, if I have a ruptured appendix, that is exactly the algorithm I want them running.
Oh, 100%. Find the inflamed organ, isolate the pathology, and cut it out. For acute localized problems, that reductionist approach is totally indispensable.
But, and here's the big but. The danger comes when we take that exact same algorithm and apply it to chronic, complex, multi-system illnesses.
Yes, because the conventional encounter is organized entirely around your symptoms, your organ systems, and your lab thresholds. It relentlessly hunts for the biological lesion. But by doing that, it severely underexamines what Dr. Sally calls the lived field.
The lived field, so meaning the patient's actual life.
Right. A clinician might look at your lab result, correctly diagnose you with type 2 diabetes, follow the absolute highest tier clinical guidelines, and prescribe insulin. But if they don't factor in your life constraints, that correct diagnosis becomes practically useless.
Okay, let me try to use an analogy here to see if I'm tracking. So conventional medicine is basically like a highly skilled mechanic who's perfectly tuning a car's engine.
Okay, I like this.
Right, so the mechanic hooks it up to the computer, changes the spark plugs, uses the best synthetic oil. The engine is running flawlessly. But they completely fail to notice that the car is literally sunk up to its axles in a swamp.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
So the engine works, the diagnosis was right, the intervention was right, but the car still can't drive.
Exactly. And Dr. Salehi explains this by differentiating between a disease pattern and a constraint pattern.
Okay, break that down for me.
So the disease pattern is what is biologically wrong. That's the engine trouble. It's the mechanism of the lesion, the inflammation, the altered biomarker.
The thing you can see on a blood test.
Right. But the constraint pattern explains why the organism's adaptive capacity is narrowing. It maps out why the treatment is failing or why the symptoms are persisting despite technically correct interventions.
It's the swamp.
It's the swamp. So instead of just asking what disease is present, medicine has to shift and equally ask what pattern is constraining this person's capacity to live, to adapt, and to heal.
Okay, let me push back on this for a second, because I can hear a doctor listening to this right now and saying, look, I am a cardiologist. My job is the pump, the valve, the electrical system of the heart. Why is the swamp my responsibility? I'm not a social worker. I just need to fix the engine.
And that is the most common pushback. But it relies on this false dichotomy between biology and the environment. And this is where the paper leans heavily into the work of theoretical biologists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela.
Okay, we're getting into the heavy science now.
Just a little bit. But it's so important. They coined this concept called autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis.
Yeah, which literally translates to self-creation. Basically, at a cellular level, a living system is constantly regenerating its own components. Like a cell has a boundary, right? A membrane that defines it against the outside world.
Sure, like the skin of the cell.
Right. But to maintain that boundary, to stay alive, it has to engage in a continuous active exchange of energy and matter with its environment.
It has to pull in oxygen and push out waste.
Exactly. And Maturana and Varela called this structural coupling. The organism and its environment, its niche, they are structurally coupled. They constantly perturb and shape each other. You literally cannot decouple the organism from its niche without killing it.
So you can't just separate the heart from the human's life?
No, you can't. So to answer your hypothetical cardiologist, you can't just fix the pump, because the pump's literal cellular structure is being dynamically remodeled by the patient's lived environment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, think about it. If a patient is living under chronic financial terror, say they are facing eviction, their amygdala is constantly firing.
That's the fear center of the brain, right?
Exactly. Which signals the hypothalamus, which triggers the pituitary gland, which then dumps cortisol and adrenaline directly into the bloodstream from the adrenal glands.
And that cascade physically alters the heart.
It absolutely does. That neuroendocrine flood drives up the heart rate. It tightens the vasculature. It promotes systemic inflammation. It increases platelet aggregation. The swamp is actively altering the engine.
Right.
So if the cardiologist just prescribes a blood pressure pill, but completely ignores the structural coupling that is actually generating the high blood pressure, they are fighting a losing battle against the patient's own survival mechanisms.
That is wild to think about. Really reframes everything. Because that brings us to the core concept of the paper, life coherence. And I want to be clear here, because if we're structurally coupled to our environment, coherence doesn't just mean having a perfect stress-free life, like doing yoga on a beach all day.
No, not at all. Living systems are never static. They survive through continuous perturbation and adaptation. Life coherence in this framework just means achieving a viable alignment among the core processes that allow your life to continue.
So keeping the plate spinning.
Pretty much. It's the functional alignment of your metabolic pathways, your circadian rhythms, and your immune function, right alongside your income, your physical safety, and your relationships.
And when those things align, it creates what the paper calls adaptive margin.
Yes, adaptive margin. This is a critical, critical concept.
Let's really dig into this, because I feel like this term alone changes the entire vocabulary of a doctor's visit. What exactly is adaptive margin?
Think of it as the total reserve a person has available. It's your physiological buffer, your cognitive buffer, and your socioeconomic buffer. It's the amount of disturbance you can absorb without your entire system collapsing.
Okay, so let's make this super concrete for the listener, because the paper gives great examples. Let's imagine two different patients who both walk into a clinic on the same day and receive the exact same biological diagnosis. Let's say newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes.
Okay, perfect scenario. Let's look at patient A.
Why?
This individual has high adaptive margin. They consistently get 8 hours of good sleep, which means their insulin sensitivity isn't being blunted by exhaustion.
Right, their body is rested.
Yeah. They have a stable, well-paying job, they have a supportive partner, and they live in a safe, walkable neighborhood with a good grocery store. Now, when their doctor hands them this diagnosis and gives them a new diet and prescribes a daily medication that's a disturbance, it's definitely an unwanted perturbation in their life.
But they have the buffer to handle it.
Exactly. They have the cognitive bandwidth to read nutritional labels at the store. They have the financial margin to actually buy the slightly more expensive Whole Foods.
And they can go take a walk after dinner safely.
Right. Their structural coupling with their environment actually supports the biological adaptation that the treatment plan requires.
Okay, so that's patient A. High margin. Now, contrast that with patient B, same exact biological diagnosis, same target blood sugar levels, Same printed pamphlet handed to them by the doctor.
But patient B has critically low adaptive margin. Let's say this person is working two minimum wage jobs with rotating shifts.
So their circadian rhythm is completely destroyed.
Completely. On top of that, they're the sole caregiver for an aging parent with dementia. They live in a neighborhood where it's not safe to walk at night, and they're dealing with intermittent food insecurity.
Wow.
Yeah. The biological burden of the diabetes is identical to patient A, but the constraint pattern is radically different. When the doctor gives patient B that exact same treatment plan, it isn't just unhelpful, it is actively destabilizing.
Because it's asking for resources they just do not have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The demand to cook specialized meals, to schedule follow-up appointments, to pay for medications, it completely overwhelms a system that was already operating at maximum capacity just to survive the day.
And here is where I think the conventional system gets genuinely cruel. Mm-hmm. Because when patient B comes back in 3 months and their blood sugar is worse and they admit they haven't been filling the prescription, what happens? The medical chart gets stamped with that terrible word, non-compliant.
Yes, the dreaded non-compliant label.
We basically blame the patient for failing the plan instead of looking at it and realizing the plan failed the patient. It carries this really heavy kind of unspoken moral judgment, like you aren't trying hard enough.
And the life coherence model aggressively dismantles that moralism. It recognizes that when we talk about lifestyle choices, we're often just using a sanitized term for structural barriers.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
Like when a patient's neuroendocrine system is flooded with stress hormones because of poverty, their prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that handles long-term planning and impulse control, is literally downregulated.
The brain goes into survival mode.
Right. Seeking out calorie-dense, highly processed food isn't a moral failing when you're in that state. It is a biologically hardwired survival imperative during times of perceived scarcity. The life field itself is constraining the very possibility of change.
So the doctor's role fundamentally shifts. It's no longer about lecturing the patient on willpower. It's about diagnosing the constraints. It changes the question from, why is this patient refusing to change, to what would actually have to become possible in this person's environment for change to even be an option?
Beautifully said. And that leads us directly into the clinical application. Like, how does a doctor actually do this in a 15-minute appointment? The paper lays out four specific pillars for the clinical encounter. And pillar one is what Dr. Sayali calls the coherence history.
Okay, so let's get into pillar one. Taking a history has always been the foundation of a doctor visit, right? Tell me what hurts. Translating human suffering into data. But a conventional history is really just a symptom timeline. When did the chest pain start? Does it radiate down your arm? Does it hurt more when you breathe?
Exactly. It's treating the patient like a biological crime scene. You're just dusting for prints, gathering clues of the pathology.
Right. So how does the coherence history change that?
Well, it preserves the hunt for the pathology. You obviously still need to know if the chest pain radiates to the jaw. But it expands the scope to a life field chronology. It asks a much deeper question. What life has been interrupted by this illness? Or what was happening in your life right before the illness accelerated?
Because disease doesn't just happen in a vacuum.
Exactly. The onset is rarely random. Did the patient's rheumatoid arthritis suddenly flare up a month after a really grueling divorce? Or did their blood sugar spike out of control right after their landlord raised the rent and forced them to take on a third job?
But and I want to be careful here, the doctor isn't suddenly becoming a therapist, right? But they aren't saying the rent increase literally biologically caused the diabetes.
No, that's a vital nuance. They aren't assigning simplistic linear causality. They're identifying constraints. They're mapping out the landscape where the recovery has to happen. And the paper breaks these constraints down into specific domains.
Okay, what are they?
Things like sleep architecture, food access, movement, work demands, financial strain, relational dynamics, meaning. And then, perhaps the most overlooked constraint of all, treatment burden.
Oh, treatment burden. We need to spend some time here.
Yeah.
Because this is huge. This is when the medical care itself becomes the swamp.
Yes. It's iatrogenic loss of margin. Margin that is lost specifically because of medical intervention.
Give me an example of that.
Okay. Consider an elderly patient. They've got heart failure, osteoarthritis, COPD, and diabetes.
Pretty standard mix for a geriatric patient.
Right. Now, the conventional guideline-directed approach for each of those individual diseases makes perfect scientific sense in isolation. But when you stack them all together in one human being, the result is often catastrophic.
Because of the sheer volume of things they have to do.
Exactly. The patient is asked to take like 12 different pills at different times of the day. They have to monitor their fluid intake perfectly, measure their blood pressure twice a day, do respiratory exercises, and go to 4 different specialist appointments across town every single month.
Oh my God, that's a full-time job.
It is. The sheer cognitive and logistical load of managing all these cures completely consumes whatever tiny fraction of adaptive margin the patient had left.
The treatment plan literally outpaces their capacity to live. That is so wild. And the paper has this brilliant example about how a single symptom can mean 2 completely different things depending on the life field. The osteoarthritis example.
Yes, let's look at that. You have 2 patients who present with the exact same radiological evidence of knee osteoarthritis. The x-rays look identical.
Okay.
Patient 1 feels the pain, but they modify their walking route to avoid steep hills. They take a mild anti-inflammatory when they need it, and they just continue their life. The pathology is there, but it's integrated without destroying their life coherence.
But patient 2 has a totally different trajectory.
Right. Patient 2 experiences that exact same knee pain, but maybe because of a previous fall, or maybe they don't have anyone at home to help them, they become intensely fearful of falling again, so they stop leaving their apartment.
And once you stop moving?
Sarcopenia sets in. They begin to lose muscle mass. The isolation leads to depressive symptoms. The lack of movement and the spike in stress hormones severely destabilize their diabetes, which was previously under control. They gain weight.
Which puts even more mechanical stress on the arthritic knee.
Exactly. It's a vicious cycle. But on the medical chart, the diagnosis is identical for both patients. Osteoarthritis of the knee. But the lived reality for patient 2 is a catastrophic, systemic collapse of their adaptive capacity.
If the doctor only looks at the knee, they are missing the fact that the entire house is burning down around it. And this brings us right back to that word, non-compliance. If patient 2 stops taking their diabetes meds because they are too depressed to get out of bed, conventional medicine says non-compliant. But Dr. Saley introduces a much better word. Miscoupling.
Yes, miscoupling. It completely shifts the analytical gaze. It moves away from the patient's supposed behavioral failure and places the focus squarely on the interaction between the treatment plan and the patient's life field.
So a plan is miscoupled if it just clashes with reality.
Right. Is the asthma inhaler miscoupled because the out-of-pocket cost is forcing the patient to choose between breathing and paying their electricity bill? Is the diuretic, the water pill, miscoupled because the patient drives a city bus for a living and literally cannot access a restroom every hour?
Oh, wow. Yeah. You can't prescribe a drug that makes someone pee every hour if they're driving a bus.
Yeah.
It's just, it demands that the physician takes responsibility for the feasibility of the plan, not just its biological accuracy.
Precisely.
Okay. That's pill. Pillar 1, the doctor has mapped the life field and identified the constraints.
Yeah.
Now they actually have to physically examine the patient. That's pillar 2, the regulatory functional physical examination. Now, I feel like standard checkups have been the exact same for like decades. Stethoscope on the chest, take a deep breath, look in the ears, hit the knee with a little rubber hammer.
Right, the classic routine.
How does a life coherence exam change that?
Well, it requires the clinician to look at the body not merely as an anatomical map of potential diseases, but as a dynamic living ledger.
A ledger, so it's keeping score?
Exactly. The physical body physically records the story of the patient's margin. The clinician obviously still listens to the heart and lungs, but they add this continuous overriding question. What does this organism reveal about its regulatory reserve, its functional capacity, and its remaining margin?
Let's start with the most basic part of any exam, vital signs. Usually you sit down, medical assistant slaps the cuff on your arm, takes your pulse, checks your oxygen. They write the numbers down, and if they aren't flashing red and setting off alarms, nobody thinks twice about it.
Yeah. In the conventional model, vital signs are treated as these static thresholds. Are you above or below the line? But in the life coherence model, they are viewed as real-time windows into the autonomic nervous system.
Okay. Give me an example.
Let's take respiratory rate. How many breaths you take a minute? In a lot of clinics, this is honestly poorly measured or sometimes just estimated.
Yeah. They just write down 16 and move on.
Exactly. But a creeping respiratory rate, say it slowly moves from 14 breaths a minute up to 22 breaths a minute over a few months. That is often the very first physiological signal that an organism's adaptive margin is buckling under a load.
What kind of load?
It could be an early subtle infection. It could be fluid slowly backing up into the lungs from heart failure. Or it could be severe chronic anxiety. The body is increasing its work of breathing to compensate. It is actively dipping into its reserve.
But the oxygen might still look fine, right?
That's the danger. If you only look at the oxygen saturation, you might see 98% and think, great, everything is fine.
Yeah.
You completely miss the fact that the body is working twice as hard, sweating and straining, just to maintain that 98%.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
It's like looking at a car's speedometer and seeing it holding steady at 60 miles per hour, but ignoring the fact that the RPMs are completely redlining because it's driving up a 45-degree incline.
That's exactly it.
The speed is technically fine, but the engine is about to explode.
Perfect analogy.
What about blood pressure? Because the paper specifically highlights something called orthostatic blood pressure.
Oh, this is a prime example of how conventional metrics can actively harm a patient if they aren't contextualized. So typically, your blood pressure is taken while you're sitting down, right?
Yeah, always seated.
Okay, so let's picture a frail, elderly patient. They're on three different blood pressure medications. The nurse takes their seated blood pressure, and it's 120 over 80. The conventional physician looks at that number and says, excellent. You are exactly at goal. The treatment is a massive success.
But the patient doesn't live their entire life seated on an exam table.
Exactly. When that patient stands up to walk to the kitchen, gravity pulls the blood down into their legs. Normally, you have these baroreceptors in your carotid arteries that instantly detect that pressure drop. They trigger the sympathetic nervous system to constrict the blood vessels and bump up the heart rate, pushing blood back up to the brain.
It's an automatic reflex.
Right. But in an elderly patient who is heavily medicated with beta blockers and diuretics, that autonomic reflex is severely blunted. The medication stops the reflex.
So they stand up. The reflex fails, and their blood pressure just plummets.
Yes. They experience orthostatic hypotension. The brain loses perfusion for just a few seconds. They get profoundly dizzy, they stumble, and maybe they fall and break a hip. Or honestly, just as tragically, they become so terrified of the dizziness that they voluntarily confine themselves to an armchair all day.
Wow. So that seated blood pressure of 2080 was biologically correct, according to a textbook, but it was actively destroying their capacity to actually live and move.
Exactly. So a life coherence exam measures the pressure both seated and standing. It directly audits the patient's regulatory margin in a functional, real-world context.
And this kind of observation, auditing their capacity, it starts way before the stethoscope even comes out, right?
Yeah.
The paper talks about the first clinical impression.
Yes. A really skilled clinician is auditing margin from the very second they lay eyes on the patient in the waiting room.
Like just watching them.
Watching everything. How do they rise from the chair? Do they have to rock back and forth and use their arms to thrust themselves up? That indicates proximal muscle weakness.
Yeah.
As they walk down the hall, is their gait steady? Or are they walking with a really wide stance to compensate for nerve damage in their feet?
Right.
When they speak to you, can they finish a full sentence without pausing to catch their breath? These aren't just polite observations to make small talk. This is vital empirical data about the organism's structural coupling.
And this connects deeply to this physiological cascade that the paper warns about. It calls it the frailty and deconditioning loop. What is that, and how does losing margin accelerate it?
Well, the human body operates on a relentless principle of use it or lose it, especially when it comes to lean muscle mass and neurological balance. So let's say a patient gets a minor illness, like a bad flu, and they're told to just rest for 2 weeks.
Okay, pretty standard advice.
In an older adult, prolonged bed rest leads to a rapid downregulation of mitochondrial density in their muscles. Sarcopenia muscle wasting really accelerates. So when they finally get up after 2 weeks, their legs are noticeably weaker. And that weakness alters their proprioception. They feel unsteady.
And once you feel unsteady, that psychological fear kicks in.
And fear is biologically potent. The fear of falling up regulates the sympathetic nervous system. They become hypervigilant, their movements get stiff, and they start voluntarily restricting their activity. They stop walking to the grocery store.
And then their heart gets weaker.
Exactly. The decreased cardiovascular output causes their aerobic capacity to plummet. The isolation leads to depression. The depression reduces their appetite, which then just accelerates the muscle loss.
Wow.
It is this devastating, self-reinforcing loop.
It's terrifying how fast that can happen.
It is. And the whole point of the life coherence exam is to detect the very earliest signs of this loop, like just noticing that they use their hands to push out of a chair before the system completely spirals out of control.
And to do that, the paper recommends using these things called functional microtests, which I love because it sounds like something out of a high-tech sports science lab, but it's actually incredibly practical. What are microtests?
They're just brief purposeful tasks that you embed into the natural flow of the exam. So instead of sitting there and asking a patient, "Are you taking your medication every day?" where they'll probably just say yes to please you, you hand them a sample and say, "Can you show me how you open this new pill bottle?"
Show, don't tell.
Right. If they have severe arthritis in their hands and it's physically impossible for them to press down and turn the childproof cap, you've just discovered why their blood pressure is out of control.
It's not non-compliance. It's a mechanical barrier.
Exactly. Or you ask them to demonstrate their inhaler technique. A terrifying number of patients with COPD are basically just inhaling the medication into the roof of their mouth, or they're swallowing it, which means literally none of the steroid is reaching their lungs.
So you're diagnosing the interaction between the patient and the care plan. Now, there is one specific part of the physical exam that the paper highlights, and it honestly blew my mind. It holds it up as a masterclass in this approach. Examining the feet. Why is taking a patient's shoes and socks off such a profoundly revealing act?
Because examining the feet is essentially doing biological detective work on the patient's entire life field. It tells you everything.
How so?
Well, if a clinician is examining the foot of a diabetic patient, they're looking for much more than just, say, a local skin ulcer or a cut. That ulcer tells a massive story. First, obviously, it reveals biological neuropathy. The nerves have degraded so much that the patient couldn't even feel a blister forming in their shoe.
Right, the biological pathology.
But it also reveals a breakdown in their environment. It shows us the pattern of wear on their shoes. Maybe their biomechanics have shifted, or maybe they just cannot afford appropriate, well-fitting footwear.
Oh, man. And it shows if they have the physical flexibility to actually reach down and watch their feet.
All right.
Or the visual acuity to even see the bottom of their foot to check for cuts.
Exactly. It might indicate that they live completely alone and have absolutely no one to help them check their feet. It indicates a massive failure of preventative education in their care. So when you look at that diabetic foot, you aren't just looking at microvascular ischemia. You are looking at the footprint of the patient's socioeconomic status, their living conditions, and the effectiveness of their entire medical support network.
The foot is the ultimate intersection of biology and biography.
That is a perfect way to summarize it.
Okay, so we've gathered the life history, we've audited the body's functional capacity. Now the physician actually has to make decisions. They have to order tests and prescribe a treatment. Which leads us to pillars 3 and 4, purposeful investigation and the life capacity repair plan.
Right, the actionable steps.
Let's talk about testing first, because in modern medicine, there is this incredibly strong reflex to just order every lab panel under the sun. Let's run the bloods and see what we find. Why is that considered dangerous in this model?
Because testing is not a neutral act. Every single investigation you order exacts a toll on the patient's adaptive margin.
How so? Like, it's just a blood draw.
But think about the context. There's the physical burden of travel finding a ride to the lab. There's the pain of the needle. There's the financial costs, the copays. And then there is the immense psychological burden of waiting for a potentially terrifying result.
Ah, the anxiety.
Right. So the paper argues passionately against reflexive testing. It states that every single test must answer a clinically meaningful question that falls into one of 5 strict purposes. If it doesn't fit, you don't order it.
Okay, let's break those 5 purposes down. What is the first one?
The first is simply danger. The test is designed to rule out an immediate catastrophic threat to the patient's life.
Give me an example.
A patient comes in with sudden crushing chest pain. You immediately order an ECG and a troponin blood test. The purpose is binary. Are they having a myocardial infarction right now? Are they having a heart attack?
That makes perfect sense. Absolute necessity. What's the second purpose?
Diagnosis. The patient has a suspicious lump on their neck. You order a biopsy to establish the exact pathological tissue type so you can formulate an oncology plan. You are naming the entity so you know what you're fighting.
Got it. Okay, the third purpose is where I think it starts to get more nuanced. It's called lost margin. What does that mean in the context of a lab test?
So this is testing to see how much physiological reserve a known disease has already consumed.
Okay.
Let's say a patient has had severe chronic heart failure for a decade. The poor pumping of the heart means their kidneys haven't been getting adequate blood flow for years. So you order a renal function panel. You aren't trying to diagnose the heart failure. You already know they have it. You are checking to see if the kidneys are beginning to fail as collateral damage. You're measuring the progressive loss of organ margin.
You're checking the structural integrity of the surrounding systems. Okay, that's really smart. Purpose number 4, modifiable causes.
This is searching for a hidden reversible constraint. Let's say a patient with well-controlled depression suddenly experiences crushing fatigue and massive weight gain.
So the doctor might just assume the depression is getting worse.
Right, and the reflex might be to just double their psychiatric medication. Mm-hmm. But instead, you check their TSH, their thyroid-stimulating hormone. You are looking for a completely separate, modifiable biological variable that is suddenly constraining their energy.
You're looking for an easy fix before you nuke the whole system.
Exactly. And finally, the fifth purpose, meaningful trends.
Meaningful trends. So tracking stuff over time.
Yeah. This is tracking the trajectory of a chronic state to see if a treatment is actually working. Like checking an HbA1c every 6 months for a diabetic patient to see if their blood sugar control is improving.
So the strict rule here is if the test doesn't fit into one of those five purposes, if knowing the result isn't going to fundamentally alter the care plan or significantly reduce uncertainty, you do not order it. You protect the patient's margin.
Precisely. Like, if finding a mild anomaly on a CT scan is just going to lead to a cascade of more invasive biopsies that an 85-year-old frail patient physically couldn't survive anyway,
then ordering the initial scan is pointless.
Worse than pointless, it's biologically incoherent. It causes harm, anxiety, and cost without any real possibility of benefit.
Which brings us to the culmination of the whole encounter. Pillar 4, the life capacity repair plan. In conventional medicine, the goal of the plan is usually just to normalize the lab values. Lower the blood pressure below 130 over 80, lower the cholesterol, hit the metric. But the life coherence plan shifts the entire goalpost, doesn't it?
It does. The management plan is profoundly reframed. The guiding question for the doctor is no longer, what is the maximum tolerated dose of medication required to force this biomarker into a normal range?
What's the new question?
The new question is, what is the least forcing, most feasible intervention that will actually restore this patient's capacity to function?
Least forcing. I really find that phrasing interesting. It implies that medical intervention is inherently an act of force against a complex system.
It absolutely is. Every medication, every surgery is a perturbation of the organism's autopoiesis. Sometimes that force is 100% necessary to save a life. But in chronic disease, applying massive force often breaks the system. And what's fascinating about the life capacity repair plan is that sometimes the most powerful medical intervention might not be a new prescription at all.
What is it then?
Frequently, the most potent act a physician can perform is deprescribing.
Oh, taking things away.
Exactly. If an elderly patient is on 10 different medications and the complex interaction of all those drugs is causing severe brain fog, loss of appetite, and dizziness, the absolute best medical intervention is to meticulously peel away the drugs that are no longer strictly necessary.
You instantly return massive amounts of adaptive margin back to the patient.
Yes. Suddenly they can think clearly, they actually want to eat dinner, and they can walk to the bathroom without falling.
It's like you're performing triage, but for daily life.
Triage for daily life. That's a great way to think about it.
Like if a patient comes in with high blood pressure, but the coherence history reveals that they're only sleeping 3 hours a night because they're terrified of being evicted next week. The conventional reflex is to just prescribe an ACE inhibitor.
Right. Give them a pill.
But the life coherence reflex says, wait, the lack of sleep and the chronic terror are dumping adrenaline into their system, which is clamping down their blood vessels. The blood pressure isn't the root disease. It's a symptom of the eviction threat.
And this is where the actual art of medicine requires immense pragmatism. The physician obviously can't magically stop the eviction.
Right.
But they can recognize that adding an ACE inhibitor to a system overwhelmed by adrenaline is like throwing a cup of water on a grease fire. It might technically lower the pressure a tiny fraction, but it adds the burden of a new pill, a new pharmacy copay, and potential side effects like a chronic cough.
So what does a coherent repair plan look like for that person?
It might involve connecting them to a clinic social worker for housing assistance. It might mean prescribing a very mild short-term sleep aid just to break the vicious cycle of insomnia. And it means consciously holding off on the blood pressure medication until their nervous system actually has a chance to downregulate. You treat the constraints to treat the disease.
Wow. Because a simple, highly feasible plan that the patient can actually execute will always outperform a mathematically perfect complex protocol that just collapses on contact with reality.
Exactly. An unlivable plan is a failed plan. Period.
This all sounds incredibly humane, logical, and biologically sound. But, you know, we need to define the edges of the map here. Where are the boundaries? Where does this framework shine, and where is it completely inappropriate?
Dr. Sully is rigorously explicit about the boundaries in the paper, which I appreciate. The life coherence assessment is absolutely not a substitute for emergency medicine or acute biomedical intervention.
Right. If I'm brought into the emergency room in septic shock, or I'm hemorrhaging from a car crash,
or you have a blocked coronary artery, you do not need the physician to sit down and explore your life field chronology.
Yeah. Doc, don't ask me about my sleep architecture right now. Just stop the bleeding.
Exactly. In an acute crisis, the organism is failing immediately. You need fast, rigid, protocol-driven biomedical force. You need broad-spectrum IV antibiotics. You need surgical ligation, or you need a mechanical stent. The conventional reductionist method is the undisputed king of acute trauma and aggressive infection.
But where that reductionist model fails is in the long, slow burn of chronic illness. And that is exactly where life coherence shines.
It is unparalleled in managing multimorbidity, you know, patients with 3, 4, or 5 intersecting chronic diseases. It's totally essential in geriatric medicine, where frailty and loss margin are the primary drivers of mortality.
Right.
And it's highly effective in managing chronic pain and mental distress and working with those patients who frequently bounce in and out of the hospital because the conventional system just keeps discharging them into a life field that cannot support their recovery.
Oh, that actually brings up a crucial point from the paper that I wanted to hit. Transitions of care. The handover. When a patient moves from the hospital back to their primary care clinic, how does this model change that communication?
Okay, so a conventional medical handover is usually just a data list. Here are the discharge diagnoses, here are the latest lab values, here is the new medication list. It passes along the biological data, but it completely strips away the context.
It's just numbers on a page.
Right. A life coherence handover is radically different. It passes along the patient's functional baseline. It communicates, hey, this patient was admitted for heart failure and we adjusted their diuretics. But you must know that they live in a third floor walk-up apartment. Their baseline physical capacity is barely walking to the kitchen, and they absolutely cannot afford the newer expensive heart failure drug we initially tried to prescribe. Their primary goal is just to remain independent at home.
It's handing over the user manual for the patient's actual life, not just a parts list for their body. I love that. But let's talk about the risks. If a doctor adopts this mindset, what are the traps they could fall into?
The paper warns of 2 major risks. The first is that the clinical gaze becomes medically vague.
Vague.
Yeah. The clinician cannot use life stress as an excuse for sloppy diagnostics. If a patient comes in with severe abdominal pain, you cannot just say, oh, you're going through a rough divorce, your life feels distressed, and then completely miss a growing colon cancer. The biological discipline must remain razor sharp.
You can't replace the hard science of pathology with just being a really sympathetic listener.
Precisely. You need both. The second risk is that the model becomes inadvertently moralistic. The clinician has to constantly guard against judging the patient's niche.
Right, checking their own biases.
Yeah. They are observing the constraints, the poverty, the chaotic living situation, the poor diet as biological variables, not as moral failings. And crucially, the framework does not demand that the physician become the savior of the patient's social reality. A doctor simply cannot fix systemic poverty in a 15-minute visit.
Which brings up the ultimate real-world friction point. I can imagine doctors listening to this, sitting in their cars after a grueling shift where they saw 30 patients back-to-back, and they were literally screaming at the dashboard. This sounds beautiful on a white paper, but I have exactly 15 minutes per patient. I barely have time to type the billing codes into the computer, let alone map their life field, watch them take off their shoes, and assess their adaptive margin.
Yeah.
How does this framework actually survive contact with the modern medical economy?
It is the most vital pushback because the pressure on primary care clinicians right now is just crushing. They are burning out at record rates.
Totally. So how does this not just add to their workload?
Because the argument for life coherence isn't that it requires more time. It's that it requires a different quality of attention. Yes, taking a coherence history might take 3 extra minutes initially during that first visit. But let's look at the alternative. If you don't spend those 3 minutes to discover that the patient isn't taking their insulin because they're terrified of the needle or they can't store it in a fridge, You will spend the next 3 years managing the fallout.
Oh, yeah. You'll prescribe higher doses. You'll add new oral medications.
You'll deal with the side effects of those new medications. You'll order more lab tests. And eventually, you'll be managing their admission to the hospital for a catastrophic diabetic crisis.
So a moment of true, coherent clarity actually prevents a decade of miscoupled care.
It is fundamentally a matter of efficiency. We waste millions of hours and billions of dollars in the healthcare system vigorously applying correct treatments to the wrong constraints. Identifying the actual barrier to healing is the single most time-saving intervention a physician can perform.
Doing the wrong thing faster doesn't actually save time.
Man,
this has been a truly profound deep dive. We started by looking at how the incredible machinery of modern medicine can sometimes, accidentally, reduce us to a collection of broken parts, completely isolated from the reality of our daily lives. And through Dr. Cicurulli's framework, we've explored a deeply rigorous biological argument for bringing the human being back into the center of the clinical encounter.
It really is a profound evolution of the clinical method. It demands that we hold two complex truths together simultaneously. Disease is a hard biological reality that requires precise scientific intervention. But illness is always an experience lived by a human being embedded in a specific world.
To heal the disease, you must account for the world.
Exactly.
We've walked through how the history must shift from a timeline of symptoms to a map of the interrupted life. We've seen how the physical exam can audit the body's functional reserve. We've learned that every test must have a clinical purpose that respects the patient's margin, and that the ultimate repair plan must be feasible, gentle, and aimed at restoring capacity, not just fixing numbers on a chart.
It fundamentally redefines what success looks like in medicine.
It really does. So as we close this out, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. Think about an ongoing health struggle you are facing right now, or maybe a stubborn symptom that just won't resolve. Instead of solely focusing on what biological mechanism is broken inside of you, zoom out. Look at the soil. Ask yourself, what is the pattern in my environment, my schedule, or my stressors that is locking this illness in place? And what small, realistic fraction of adaptive margin can I reclaim today before I exhaust myself trying to fix the whole machine?
That is the exact question that begins the process of true, coherent healing.
And it is the perfect question to bring to your next doctor's visit. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of healing. We will catch you next time.